Anyway, I would then make my way up the bank, up to my Jeep, which, if I recall, had no top, and the Jeep would be half full of water, literally. So you'd feel around through the water in the dark and for a rubber plug in the floor, and take the rubber plug out and let all the water run out of the floor of the Jeep, put the plug back, get in, start up, and I would then drive off down to the big airstrip. I might mention that the night before I would have driven over to the squadron camp and tell Sergeant Coonert which truck number he was to use the next day, and so I could count on it that he and his crew would come over to group headquarters and get a truck and eventually drive down to the strip. Well, I'd get down there just about sunup, I suppose, and park along the side most anywhere, and eventually Sergeant Coonert and his crew would come down in the truck, and they'd find me and park beside me, and I'd get out and go over to the truck, and we would stand around talking. And before very long, a whole absolute parade of C-47s would start coming over from Port Moresby. Just a long string of them, dozens of them. And they would land, one right behind the other, and the first one would go up to the end of the strip and park, and the next one would park beside him, and the next beside him, and the next beside him, and so on. And they were all numbered, and we would know that number 22 or whatever it was ours, and we would watch for it. And when it landed, the minute it landed, we would follow it up to wherever it parked and back the truck up to it and unload our stuff off of it onto the truck. And it was extremely important that you be there and not keep those airplanes waiting, because, of course, they wanted to make as many trips in a day as they possibly could. So it would infuriate them, naturally, if they got there and there was nobody waiting to unload the stuff. Not to mention the fact that you always ran the risk that if you weren't there and somebody else noticed it, they'd back up there and take your stuff. And it was, again, lumber and screen wire and dear knows what all, stuff we needed, and stuff everybody needed, and nobody was above stealing other people's stuff if they could get their hands on it. But as long as there was somebody there, nobody ever bothered you. So we would unload all this stuff and put it on the truck, and the minute we had got it all off, that C-47 would taxi out and take off and go back to Moresby for another load. We, in the meantime, would drive down to the camp and unload the stuff and be ready to come back in a couple hours to get another load. And, of course, we could go to our camp and unload a lot faster than the C-47s could climb up over the mountains and back down to Port Moresby and load up and climb back up the mountains and back down over. I don't really remember how long a round trip took, but it would be probably more than 2 hours, 3 hours maybe, I don't know, but in the meantime, of course, the crew there at the campsite had their work cut out for them, and not all of them went over there to unload the truck. Sergeant Coonert always came over, and a couple of others, but the rest of them stayed on the campsite and worked at their job. And that's what we would do all day long. And I had other things to do, though I can't rightly remember just now what they were. But I wasn't in a position to just sit around and do nothing till the next trip came over. You always have to scrounge stuff and so forth. And I'll give you a for example. It was and it came close to the time when Sergeant Coonert was going to mix and pour concrete. He had to have pipe, so that he could pipe water from the river up to the area where he was going to mix concrete. And I suppose they must have had some sort of pump they used to pump the water, but we did not have any pipe. And we needed large pipe, about 1.5 inch pipe is what they wanted. And they needed quite a lot of it, several hundred feet probably. So it was my business to scrounge up some pipe. We only wanted to borrow pipe. We didn't need to have any to keep. We just needed to borrow some for 3 or 4 days. So I went on this occasion over to one of the engineer depots and told them what I wanted. I wanted X number of feet of 1.5 inch pipe. Well, they were very reluctant to let me have it, as I knew would be the case from the very beginning, because they often let people borrow stuff. That's what they were supposed to do, as a matter of fact. But on many occasions, of course, they didn't get it back. And that made them mad, and it made them wary and suspicious. And this officer of some kind came out, and he said, well, he said, look, Lieutenant, I'm going to let you have this pipe because I know you need it. And but I want you to give me your word that you will return this pipe to us when you're through with it, because you're not the only person around here that needs pipe. And if you don't bring it back, then somebody else who needs it won't have it. So I want you to promise me that when you're done with this pipe, you'll bring it back to us. And I swore on a stack of Bibles I would do so. And I might as well finish this story right now while I'm on it. And that was that much later, after the squadron had moved over and we were all settled, and we still had the engineer's pipe. And the supply officer was a man named Lieutenant Correll. And I asked him one day if he still had that pipe, and he said, well, yes, of course. And I said, well, we have to give it back to the so-and-so engineers. And, he said, hell that, we're going to, and I said, you use for it. Yeah, we don't, but who knows, sometime we might need some pipe. That's good pipe. We got it, we're going to keep it. And I said, you're not going to keep it. I said, I borrowed that pipe, and I gave my word that it would be returned when we were through with it, and it's already a week or so later, and we are through with it, and we haven't returned it, and you're going to return it. You've got to, because I promised. And he said, oh, those promises don't mean anything. Nobody believed you in the first place, and we've got it, and we're going to keep it. And I said, you're not keeping it. And I was going to go as high up as I needed to go to be sure the damn pipe got returned. Well, I guess when he saw I meant business, he did indeed get the pipe loaded up and taken back and returned, which was a considerable satisfaction to me, because I know a lot of people would borrow that stuff and not return it, and at least here was one outfit that borrowed pipe and said they would return it and actually did so. A much more critical matter was the matter of cement. Cement was worth its weight in gold, practically, over there. And, of course, somebody, somewhere, had allotted us X number of sacks of cement. And this allotment of cement came out of a dwindling supply and a hard-to-get supply, and it was crucial. Somewhere along about this time, I had been introduced to a colonel, a full colonel, who was attached somehow to 5th Air Force Advanced Headquarters. The 5th Air Force themselves had a headquarters over at Dobradura, and there again was like everybody else's headquarters. It was nothing but a bunch of tents in the jungle up near the hospital, as I remember. And this was a colonel by the name of Eades, E-A-D-E-S. And he was a total gentleman, if there ever was one. And I forget what his function was, but as far as I was concerned, he was the man that I should go to if I ran into troubles and problems having to do with the materials for camp building. And the colonel had talked to me about the cement, and he said, "This cement will be coming over in such and such a day, such and such a time, and you are to be on hand there to get it. Because if you don't, somebody else will, and you will never get any more. You're going to have to do without. This is all there is. You don't get a second chance if you lose it." And he was very nice about it, but he made the situation plain, and he didn't need to go beyond that. I knew what the situation was. So when the appointed time came, and Sergeant Coonert and his truck and his men and I and my Jeep went down to the strip, and we waited for this airplane, and it never came. And we waited till late in the day, and it never came. And I didn't know what to do next, because we needed the cement the next day. We were ready to start mixing and pouring. So I drove up to 5th Air Force and came on Colonel Eads, who was putting up his tent and fixing it up. And he stopped work and came over and started talking to me. And I told him that as far as I could tell, we hadn't gotten our cement. And he said, "But you must have." Because he said, "I saw it, and it was stacked out, you weren't there, and it was stacked beside the runway, and I know it was there, it was yours, and I know it, I saw it." And I said, "Well, we had somehow missed it, and we're wondering what to do next." And he said, "Come on, and let's go down there, and let's hurry." And so he did. He jumped in my Jeep, and we drove in a great hurry down there. Well, by God, there, halfway down the strip, piled along the side of the runway, was our cement, still there, nobody around. And it was an absolute miracle right out of heaven that that cement was still there. The only reason it was still there was because the flights of supplies from Port Moresby for that day had ceased by that time. It was late afternoon. And they weren't making any more flights, so nobody was going down there. And because if they had, and anybody had gone down there and seen that cement, they would have taken it. But nobody went down there, and nobody saw it, and it was still there. It was a goddamn miracle, I'm telling you. Well, the colonel didn't say anything. He didn't even heave a sigh of relief, but I know that he felt a great deal of relief. He bound to, I know he did. And because he was such a gentleman, he didn't say anything either. He said simply, "Okay." He said, "You go get your sergeant in the truck and get him down here to pick up this cement, and I will stay here and look after it till you get back," which is what I did and is what he did. And we got the cement. That's the story of Colonel Eads. And it's a pity there aren't more Colonel Eadses in this world, because he was a real treasure. He could have been very nasty about this whole episode, but he never, ever said a word about how come you let that happen. And I don't know to this day myself how I let that happen, because I was on the lookout for it, and so was Sergeant Coonert, but neither one of us ever saw it arrive. Anyway, that was that story. Just before it came time to move the squadron itself over, and that would be a critical operation because it had to be done in one day, which meant that we were going to have to be assigned a whole bunch of C-47s, and they would have to haul everything we owned, lock, stock, and barrel, personnel, tents, everything, everything we had all over there in one day, and we had to meet those airplanes and pick up all that stuff and get it down to the tent area and the whole thing. And we were ready for that. But I mentioned at one point that to get to the campsite, you drove along this road and then ducked down a steep bank into the jungle. Well, right where the bank, at the bottom of the bank, there was a big mud hole, which, with the constant passage of trucks and jeeps in and out, had got muddier and deeper and worse, day by day, until it was, people ran risk of getting stuck in it. And there wasn't any way you could even walk through there without getting very wet. So Sergeant Kunert said to me that he wished there was some way we could get the engineers to bring us some truckloads of gravel and pour in that hole, fill it up with gravel. He knew they had plenty of gravel, and there wasn't any other place to get gravel and the quantities we needed, and they had dump trucks and everything, and I should go over to the 43rd Engineers or whoever they were and see if I couldn't scrounge some gravel. So I agreed that was a good advice, and I got in my Jeep and I went over to the 43rd Engineers and asked who was in charge, and I was referred to a Lieutenant Colonel somebody or other who was running this outfit, and Colonel so-and-so was located in a tent like everybody else, sat at a big wooden table like a picnic table in there, and I went in the tent and introduced myself, and he was very friendly. He said, "Well, sit down, Lieutenant. What can I do for you?" And I told him that I was from the 7th Fighter Squadron, and we were moving over to Dobadura in a day or two, and we had a problem with our campsite in that there was a huge mud hole in the entrance, and we needed some gravel. And he said, "Tell me what your name, what you said your name was again." And I told him, and he looked at me, eyed me up and down, and he said, "Do you have any relatives in LaGrange, Illinois?" And I said, "Well, yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I have a brother there, and I also have a cousin there." And he said, "Your cousin, how old a man is he?" And I said, "About your age, sir." And he said, "What's his name?" And I said, "Richard Dilworth, Dick Dilworth." He said, "Does he work at a locomotive factory?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, I know him. I know him." He said, "We used to work together years ago, and I haven't seen or heard from him for years." He said, "We used to be good friends." And, "Now," he said, "Lieutenant, what was it you wanted?" And I said, "I wanted some gravel." And he said, "How much gravel?" And I said, "I think we ought to have at least 4 truckloads. And he said, "All right, 4 truckloads. And what time do you want that gravel tomorrow?" And I said, 9 o'clock. "And where are you located?" And I told him, and he said, "All right, sir." He said, "Don't give it another thought. 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, I'll have 4 truckloads of gravel at your place. And you be there to show them where you want it dumped. And by the way, Lieutenant," he said, "the next time you write to your cousin in LaGrange, you tell him that you talked to so-and-so, and you tell him that I'm over here in New Guinea, and I'm busy building airfields and roads and bridges and dredging harbors and God knows what else, and that he ought to be over here helping me. You tell him that." Well, it was a happy experience, and I can tell you that the next morning at 9 o'clock at our camp entrance, there turned up 4 big, huge dump trucks filled with gravel, and they dumped it in our mud hole, and the mud hole disappeared. I might as well finish this story by saying that later, a month or so later, I suppose, after a passage of many more trucks and jeeps and things, the mud hole more or less reappeared. And one day Captain Manning came down to, he was the squadron commander, you remember, he came down to me and he said, Whorehouse, he said, come with me, I got something I want you to do for me. And he was in a jeep with the group commander, Lieutenant Colonel somebody. I forget who was the group commander at the moment. I think it was Colonel Morrissey. Anyway, the three of us got in the jeep, and Captain Manning said, I'm going to take you over to that engineer outfit, and he said, you're to ask him for a couple more truckloads of gravel for our entrance to our campground. You got some gravel before from him, didn't you? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, let's go over there. I want you to get him, ask him for some more. So, all right. But on the on the way over there, Colonel Morrissey said, Manning, he said, you're the squadron commander here. He said, how come you were taking Dilworth over there to ask for gravel? He's nobody. He said, you're the squadron commander. Why aren't you asking for it yourself? And Manning says, well, Colonel, he said, because, he said, this... Those guys, the head guy over there at the engineers is a Dilworth's cousin or his uncle or some goddamn thing. And he said, the long and short of it is that he won't give me any gravel, but he'll give it to Dilworth. And that was probably the truth, because I went over there and I saw the colonel again and I asked him for two more truckloads of gravel and I got them. That was one of the nice stories in connection with this business. Truth was, I really enjoyed my time over there with this advanced detail. And it was interesting, furthermore, that all my multiple physical problems that I had been plagued with ever since my airplane accident had totally disappeared. I never felt better in my life than I did over there, and I was enjoying what I was doing, and I felt just great. So, to conclude this particular story, the day came to move. We had all the trucks we needed. We met all the airplanes. And remember, as I said, we were told that we would always be told the day before what airplanes had our stuff in them. And they had big numbers on them. And so we would wait down by the runway in trucks and looking for the C-47 with our numbers on them. And we'd run up there and unload stuff. And of course, as I said, we not only had all the squadron materials and stuff, but the personnel as well. And this move was well planned, which means that the first loads in the morning that came over that day contained the enlisted men, or most of them, and the tents and the absolute necessary things. And so all day long, those guys were there and had time to set up their tents and get themselves sort of established. And the mess hall equipment was brought over first, so the cooks got a chance to set up their stoves and put away their food and learn their way around and get used to things before dark. And then the rest of the day came supplies, all the maintenance supplies and spare parts and furniture, and among other things, we had a big, huge, big diesel engine, which did nothing but run a generator so that we had electricity in the camp buildings. We had camp electricity in the mess hall. We had electricity in the showers. We had electricity in the motor pool. And eventually we were to end up with electric light in each tent. It was nothing but a bare bulb and one bulb in each tent, but each tent had a light. And I remember that took some while to set up because nothing could be done about that. till they had taken all the old wiring and stuff out of the camp over in Port Moresby and brought it over here and hooked it up, and that took a long time. And one of the pilots, I remember, complained bitterly to Captain Manning that he didn't have any lights in his tent. And Captain Manning looked at him and he said, "That's right, Lieutenant, you don't have any light in your tent, and neither do any of the other officers." And he said, "None of you are going to have any lights in your tent either until every goddamn enlisted man in the squadron has a light in his tent, and then you will get yours." And that's the way it happened, and that was the kind of CO he was. It is important to remember at this stage that the enlisted men in a fighter squadron don't do any fighting. They do all the dirty work, pretty much. But you see, in a bomber squadron where some of the air crews are enlisted men, they get to share in the excitement of things. The only excitement there is the flying. That's what this outfit is about. And since the enlisted men in a fighter squadron don't get to do any flying, they don't get to share in the excitement particularly. And that means they not only lead kind of miserable lives physically, but they're all extremely tiresome. And they don't get to go on leave much. Efforts were made to give the enlisted men leave from time to time, but they would go for a year before they got any leave. And sometimes not then. Naturally, a lot of them had trouble at home. Their wives would run off, and their children would die, and this would happen, and that would happen, and not a thing could be done for them except to give them sympathy. They couldn't go home and take care of these situations. They couldn't do anything. So it was important that any little thing you could do to make their lives easier, a proper squadron commander would do. And Captain Manning was one of the best in that regard. I remember one time I went down to Brisbane to ferry back a new airplane, and I managed to get hold of a case of rum. I couldn't get any whiskey. Nobody would sell me any, but they did let me have a case of rum, and I took all those bottles and put them in the ammunition bays and flew them back up, and I gave the whole goddamn case to my crew chief. And of course they didn't care. Liquor was liquor. They were happy to see it because they never got any. I said, "Sergeant Beasley, here is a case of rum." I said, "It's yours. And I don't want you anywhere around my airplane till you've finished drinking the goddamn stuff." Whether he was or not, I don't know, but they were pleased to get it. I remember one time Captain Manning told me, he said, "Well, you know," he said, "your crew chief told me once," he said, "you know why I like being Lieutenant Dilworth's crew chief," he said, "because he's one of the few pilots that talks to you. When he comes back from a mission, he tells you everything that happened. He talks to you," he said. "Most of the others don't. They just get in their jeep and drive off, and you never hear a word about anything." And I did try to do that. Truth is, I don't think I did it to be nice or to relieve the monotony of their lives. I did it just because I liked talking to them. But I suppose when it came down to it, it served the same purpose. Well, the squadron got moved over, and according to Captain Manning, he said, "This is the first time I have ever moved this squadron anywhere, and we got everything over here," he said, "on time, and not, as far as I know, one single solitary lost piece of equipment. Everything we sent over got over here, and we've got it." And he said, "That's a milestone." Of course, that wasn't, for the most part, any credit of mine, though a little bit might have been. But mainly I was terribly pleased because I was constantly beset on this day by various of the pilots who'd come up to me and say, "Where's my flight bag? Where's my bed? Where's my this and where's my that?" And suggesting that it had been lost and it was my fault. But when the end of the day came, nothing had been lost. And I didn't get any complaints about personal belongings being lost, which was a boon, because in a move that big, you could pretty well expect, especially personal belongings, are going to get stolen somewhere along the line, some of them. But they weren't. I enjoyed those days at Dobadura, but I was glad to be back with the squadron and all the people I knew, and to have my own tent again and my own bed and be amongst my own people. But it was a good experience for me. I learned a lot out of it. Next tape, I'll describe the campground a little bit, because we were located there for a long time, and it was by far the nicest camp we had ever had.